around like 10 months, I had to do all these odd jobs. I was working kind of like 10 hours every day. I was also trying to build my network and trying to land a job. So that 10 months was really brutal because I didn't have any connection. I didn't have too much money. I was kind of like almost week to week, day to day kind of situation financially. I basically almost cried every day or like every couple of days in subway, 3 in the morning. I was alone in the subway, L train station. That was probably one of the toughest year of my like last like decade almost.
Hey everybody, welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. Today is episode number 75. I'm your host, Roman Zelichenko. I am a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur, the founder of Laborless, which is an immigration tech startup that automates H-1B visa compliance, and the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the immigration and global mobility industry, and of course also brings you this show. So today, the 75th episode, I'm really excited. We're going to be talking to a slightly different type of company founder. We've traditionally talked to a lot of folks who are in the immigration, maybe case management space, or working with immigrants or immigration attorneys throughout the legal process, and a lot of other folks who are building different products and tools within the broader global mobility space. Today's guest, Siam Hossein, he is the founder and CEO of a company called Algorizon. And so Algorizon is basically like a boot camp for international students who are, of course, themselves non-US citizens. So they've become immigrants in the US. And the idea is for the company Algorizon to help them upskill, particularly with technical skills, to help them land really good jobs once they graduate from school. Really interesting company and really interesting business model too, because the idea is the students actually don't pay for the service, but they are, once they find a job, they work with the company, sign an agreement that basically part of their salary for some period of time goes to the company. So it's great. It's no upfront fee for the students who, very often don't have a lot of money, and it's great skills for them. And then, of course, at the end of the day, they get a great job and are able to move on, hopefully, with their life here in the U.S. Okay, I don't want to do the whole episode with me because the whole idea here is to talk to Siam. So, Siam, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate you, man. Thank you. I'm excited for this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
I hope I did some justice to the company, to the business in the beginning there.
You do better than me, man. I have to learn how to do it.
Nice. And I'm excited about this also in part because, at least in my, kind of the folks I've had on the show and the companies we've talked to, there's been some focus on international students, but very often the focus is on kind of broader immigration, whether it's family related or work related. International students is kind of a different thing. There's not a big barrier to coming. Obviously, it costs money to attend the school, but like from a legal sort of visa standpoint, if you get into the school, typically the student is able to get their visa and come into the U.S. without like caps and things like that. So it's kind of this field that is taken for granted, I think, a little bit, but at the same time, I mean, as far as I've seen, and not always paid attention to. So it's really awesome that, you're focusing on this, putting your energy into it, in part, of course, because you were an international student of your own. So I kind of want to start there. I want to start, in the beginning. We'll obviously get to what the company does and how you're helping international students today. But you were not from the U.S., right? So tell me a little bit about, kind of where you grew up and what that was like before you came to the U.S. To attend grad school.
Sure. So I was originally born in Bangladesh. And interestingly, I was unknowingly actually also a little bit immigrant because I grew up in Saudi Arabia. So I was born in Bangladesh. My parents moved to Saudi Arabia when I was really young. I kind of had my childhood in Saudi Arabia and then came back to Bangladesh for my like high school, because the school system in Saudi Arabia wasn't the best for English, or like it wasn't as developed when I was growing up. So I had a mixed childhood, a little bit in Saudi Arabia and then in Bangladesh. But when I finished my bachelor's in Bangladesh, I had not too much idea almost at all about US. The only thing I had was just by watching like Spider-Man, and basically my relation with US was Spider-Man, that Spider-Man grew up in Manhattan. I want to be like Spider-Man. So I want to go to Manhattan. That was kind of like very childish kind of dream. I had zero idea about what will happen after I come here, but that's basically the reason I came to US. I'll have to credit it to Spider-Man.
Wow. That is amazing. I love that. And, you know, I think, you know, I grew up in the US. I was born in Ukraine, but I came here when I was two. So really my memories are from the US. I take for granted that, you know, especially New York City where I grew up, but really America in general is truly in the media. It's in comic books and movies, cartoons, you know, songs. And like, yeah, a lot of the rest of the world really watches it and has this sort of idea of what it is like to be here. And I kind of am like, yeah, you know, I just take the sub, I take the New York City subway to school every day, and people are like, wow, that's so cool. I love that. And, you know, I guess all the students that you're working with today can credit Spider-Man to you being here and helping them. So before you came here, you studied in Bangladesh. When you were kind of moving around between Saudi Arabia and Bangladesh as kind of a younger person, did that feel like immigration to you, or was it just like following family to wherever they had to go and just, you know, you didn't think about it?
That's a very good question. No, I think it was mostly I was just following family. It did not feel like immigration in terms of visa status because I didn't have to deal with the logistics, but it did feel that I do not belong anywhere. That started beginning from my childhood that, okay, like, am I actually Bangladeshi or am I Saudi? I cannot fully relate with Saudis because I speak Bengali, but then when I'm in Bangladesh, I'm like, oh, this is also different. So that feeling probably kind of stayed even until now. So yeah.
That's interesting. And I'll tell you what, I grew up here, but I also felt like I wasn't born here, so I can't say that. But I also didn't have an immigrant experience where I came when I was older. And so I think a lot of people struggle with that sort of identity, especially if they've moved around either since childhood or whatnot. So that's really interesting. And so you studied computer or engineering when you were in Bangladesh. And I guess you said there was a more progressive kind of English as well in the universities.
Yeah, so I mean, I studied my bachelor's in electrical engineering in Bangladesh. And when I was in Saudi Arabia, I was actually going to a Bangladeshi embassy school. So that's why I didn't go to a Saudi regular school. So maybe that school system wasn't not developed just for the Bangladeshi embassy people. But yeah, so maybe that is a little correction there.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. And so, and actually I'm curious, I mean, if you can share, like what was your family doing? I mean, was it for work that they moved and you all moved to Saudi?
Yeah. So my dad is a doctor, so he just moved there and I basically had no choice. I was just 1 month.
Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, wow. So when you moved there when you were 1 month, so you really kind of, when you were little, you grew up in Saudi.
Yeah. I was born in Bangladesh in a hospital, and the next month my mom dad flew with me to Saudi Arabia.
Wow! And so, when did you finally move back to Bangladesh, or did you go back a lot, maybe to see family and friends?
Mostly just like probably once every 2 years or something. But I moved back when I was in the sixth grade. So when I was in the sixth grade, I moved back to Bangladesh.
Wow!
Yeah,
that's a tough time to move too, because you know you're kind of adolescent and you're going through changes and you know your friends are so important to you and all that kind of stuff.
Totally. Yeah, so I when I moved there, I was just like getting into preteen kind of age, and then that's why the identity crisis really hit me a lot that time. And I had a very tough time in the first 2-3 years just to connect with all these Bangladeshi kids who grew up in Bangladesh. And I moved to Dhaka, which is the capital. It has 20 million people. It is basically like New York, basically. So it's ruthless, it's fast. And in Saudi Arabia, I was kind of like living in a little bit bubble with this Bangladeshi embassy kids. So that was kind of like a shock. I realized that I'm very naive. I'm not street smart. I had a very hard time adjusting, but I think it was good. Like eventually the Dhaka or Bangladesh kind of grew into me. I'm like, okay, I love this city life. So yeah.
That's super cool. So before we move on, I just want to say for folks who are watching or tuning in, leave a comment, say hello, tell us where you are, where you're watching from, you know, tell us where you work, you know, drop a comment, and obviously, ask any questions along the way. We've got a couple comments here. From Christine says, hi, Siam. Hey, Christine, thank you for the comment. And Anna as well, who I think works with you. You guys work together. Yeah. Anna says, great seeing you here, Siam. And thank you, Anna, for your comment and for being here, for tuning in. Hopefully you learned something about Siam that maybe you didn't know. I don't know. We'll see. All right. So you had this really kind of eclectic childhood of you know, born in Bangladesh, lived in Saudi, then moved back to Bangladesh. And like you kind of, both cities, I feel like it sounds like are in you, right, in a way. Or both, I suppose, both regions or both countries. At the same time, you loved Spider-Man and you had this idea of moving to New York City. When you obviously did your undergrad in Bangladesh and you finished with an engineering degree, and then you were going to the you're going to apply for grad school. I know you wanted to be in New York. Was the idea, let me go to graduate school in New York City because it's how I can move to America? And sort of what was that process like of going through the application process? What schools do you apply to? I mean, I didn't know what I was doing for college, and I grew up here. I can't imagine being from somewhere else and thinking through all these things. So how did you go through that, and why did you decide on, you know, where you went to school?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. And like trying to think of how the connection with Spider-Man led here. But so when I was graduating, I think in the fourth year, I wasn't even sure that I'll come to US because there were a lot of opportunities in Bangladesh as well. I studied electrical engineering and primarily was focusing on telecommunication, and telecommunication was really booming that time when I was graduating. I'm not sure if it was upgrading to 3G or like some older technology, but it was going through a massive boom. All these telecom companies are going through. And I had a huge dilemma that time, choosing that should I actually work in this big salaried position in Bangladesh or go to abroad, which is probably going to be US or Canada. Canada, just because it's a little bit easier in terms of immigration sometimes. So I wasn't sure. And the decision-making process, I remember that one of my friends actually influenced the whole thing. So after I graduated, I actually started working in an airlines company, not a telecom company, airlines company in Bangladesh. It's the national airlines company. I was an engineer there. And I was also doing my MBA there. It's the best MBA school in Bangladesh. I started my MBA. And on the side, I was also running my own tutoring center in Bangladesh in the garage. So that's how I, like after graduating, that's what I was doing. And in my mind, I had this, like I wanted to go to US or Canada. Like I just want to go there, but I don't know how to do it. And there wasn't enough guideline. So I started applying, not knowing that I applied both in US and in Canadian universities, like throughout different schools. And I basically hired back. I wasn't financially able to actually pay for the whole school, so I had to get scholarship. So I was applying for a scholarship as well. And I hired back from University of Houston, which is like an average school in Texas. And they gave me like a scholarship. And I got some also good offers from other schools, but they are not fully paid off. So I'm like, okay, I have to get this scholarship one. So I remember that when I got that offer, I was actually talking with a lot of my friends and seniors and parents that, okay, what should I do now? I'm doing MBA here in the best MBA school in Bangladesh. And then I have my own tutoring center. I am making a lot of money compared to my age there. And I'm also working in an airlines company, which has a good engineering prospect. Like it's a good job. I'm like an airlines engineer, which is also like a very cool job just to have. And on the other hand, I got this scholarship in University of Houston. And the dilemma was that I spoke with a lot of friends, and everyone kind of like suggested me something which made sense to them. Like, okay, you can do this. You can stay in Bangladesh. You will have a good career growth. Why take risk? Everyone said their own opinion, because that's when I understood that people cannot really give me advice for my life because they will come from their own viewpoint. But one of my friends said that, Siam, just imagine yourself choosing either of these paths. So let's say you stay in Bangladesh. What will you do after 5 years? I'm like, okay, maybe I'll be a great airlines engineer. I'll finish my MBA and probably I'll build this huge tutoring center, because I was very passionate about building. I had this drive of building things even from my like early age. So like, okay, this sounds very awesome. that I will build this and this will be a huge multi something Bangladeshi Taka company. And it sounded exciting. And the US path, I don't know. After finishing master's, I don't know what will happen. I might be the next, I don't know, whatever is the famous person in US, or no one might know me. But what actually attracted me in choosing the US path was that it's uncertain. And my friend said that you don't know what will happen. And if you don't take this path, you won't ever know. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to take this one then. Because I always had this drive fundamentally from my childhood is that I really am attracted to uncertainty. Whenever something I don't know, I have to open this door and see. Sometimes it actually led me to a lot of failure and pain. But the reason is not a very logical and solid reason. But I actually chose US because it was uncertain on what would happen in the long run. So that's basically how I chose it. But yeah, I'll probably pause now.
It's like, it's uncertain, but that's exciting, right? And I guess, and I think that you have to have some level of confidence that you can deal with the uncertainty. I mean, because I can imagine the flip side is you know, the door that leads to who knows where, you're terrified to open it because you think of all, what if this bad thing happens? What if I can't deal with it? What if I, you know, mess up and fail? I guess you also probably fundamentally have this idea that you can figure it out at least, you know, which is, you know, really cool. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, in my view, have that kind of instinct because that's what every day you wake up and you have no idea what's going to happen. No one's telling you what to do. You don't have a boss giving you directions. You have to wake up and make your own life you have to make your own work every single day. And of course that's scary. And I'm curious, actually, you said, you know, since you were a kid, did you like have businesses when you were little? I mean, you clearly were in undergraduate studies and working and you had this side business. Were you like buying and selling things or fixing things when you were young? Were you that kind of a kid or not really?
While studying in university, the financial or the economics wasn't built into my mind fully, but I was always like creative. So when I was younger, I made my own language system of like new letters and stuff. I always like creative stuff. When I was in the university, I was directing movies and editing. We actually had, when I was in my university, we made two full-length movies, 2 hours long each, with our students and everything. So, and we had like a lot of music videos. So I was very involved in movie production and all those, which is not entrepreneurship, but it is like more creation, building, working with team. All these are kind of like, there are soft skills which are eventually transferable. But I think like how money came into the picture was like, okay, like if I want to make something sustainable, I need money. So that eventually slowly grew into the creativity, grew into entrepreneurship slowly.
And why tutoring? Because I think, you know, that's interesting to me because you did eventually do some more work in tutoring with study abroad programs. And then, of course, now with Algorithm, you are working with students. Was there something about tutoring where you kind of wanted to help younger people or something like that?
Yeah, that is a good question. And even answering this question makes me happy. So definitely this is my thing. So when I was actually just, I started tutoring just as a kind of like a casual, like, let me try it out kind of thing that I know this. I know I have gone through GRE for application and I actually started tutoring just for GRE. Let me just do this GRE tutoring. For GRE, you have to learn a lot of these words. So I also loved Greek mythology. I connected with all these words with Greek mythology. It brings the nerd out of me. But the thing about tutoring is that whenever I went to the classes and taught these kids, like 30 people in the class or 30 to 50 people, they were so excited when I presented these ideas. And I just loved seeing them so excited learning something that, oh, I never thought of it this way. Oh, that this word is connected with this Greek word and this is how I remember it. And this is so cool. And then we have this conversation and this person also gave me a new idea every time I went to a class. So when I teach something, I actually learn more from every class because they're giving me more data points. Mm-hmm. And I'm fundamentally someone who learns learning. And I found that the best way to learn something is just learn a little bit and then just start tutoring. This also brings me to more and some interesting story. I don't know if I even shared it with anyone. So when I was in university, I was not very studious. I did not study the whole year. So whenever the finals were coming, just before 2-3 weeks, basically what I did is that there were this, we all lived in dorms, and there were this, all these cool, what should I say, like good, like more better students, the better students who were kind of like giving everyone free lectures in the dorm rooms. That, okay, you wanted to talk about electric circuits, they're giving tutors, like teaching. And what I did is that I went to all these 2 or 3 major tutors, basically who are our friends, and learned all these things. And in my room, created my own tutoring thing that, all right, I got the lecture from this guy and this guy and this guy. And then I will combine all this material and give it in a more easier way, which I always did before all the exams. And everyone also liked that as well from me. So I realized that I have this thing of collecting data from everyone and kind of like distributing it in an easier way where more mass people can relate. So I think I had that a little bit in me, but eventually I realized that I always ask this question to everyone, is that what is this thing you want to create where you would pay people money because you are so happy doing it? Then my answer was that, okay, mentoring or tutoring. I would actually pay people money if needed, because it just makes me so happy. So that's pretty much it.
And clearly it gives you value too. You learn from it, you grow from it, and you see the value in that. And that's so fascinating. What a great bilateral relationship, right? They're learning from you, you're learning from them. It's really kind of like an ideal win-win scenario.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And I think that's such a good foundation, right? Because at this point, you've got entrepreneurial, kind of knack. You have this love for learning and also love for educating others and tutoring. And so that's, I mean, amazing foreshadowing for, you know, what you do, what you end up building. But if we go back a little bit, you know, okay, great. You moved to the US, you're now studying you're getting your master's in engineering. You eventually get a job, you had multiple jobs after graduating, but they were on the technology side, right? And of course, you end up working in software as well. What was that experience like for you as an international student? When you were in school, you know, from an immigration standpoint, and then B, as you were getting ready to graduate, you obviously had to go find a job in a new country where you don't maybe know as many people as others. How was that experience for you?
It was not very pretty. So basically, after I finished my graduation, finished my master's, so I was in Houston, Texas. That's why I was telling you that I have a lot of friends there. So I moved from Houston to New York, not because of Spider-Man, but because a lot of my friends actually said that in New York, there are a lot more opportunities of job in general, primarily in software. And I did my master's in more in fabrication, more in depth in electrical engineering. Fabrication is basically like creating the IC chips, what Intel does or Texas Instruments does. So basically creating these IC chips. But I wanted to go more in software because I wanted to do something or build something where I can work closely with people. And fabrication is just a little bit more on the hardware level, not so much front facing. So I moved to New York because I heard there are more opportunities in general. And long story short, what happened is that I had 1 or 2 friends who said that they might have some opportunity, but the moment I went to New York, all those opportunities were gone. And basically I ended up leaving everything in Houston. I drove my $2,000 Nissan Altima to New York. It broke down on the way a couple of times. But anyway, I was in New York, and I just to survive in New York, I had to do a lot of odd jobs. So I was working in these food trucks. I'm sure you know this halal food trucks in New York. So you didn't see me, but I was there 6 months. And then I was also working in these restaurants, all in cash, obviously not fully legal, but I was doing all those things. And essentially, I had to kind of like survive in that time for around like couple months, like at least like I would say I moved in March. So it was around like 10 months. I had to do all these odd jobs while I was trying to. So I was working kind of like 10 hours every day, all days I was working in these things. And I was also trying to build my network and trying to land a job. So that 10 months was really brutal because I didn't have any connection. I didn't have too much money. I was kind of like almost week to week, day to day kind of situation financially. And I also had to basically just build the network and apply for a job, which is also another full-time thing because you have to go to interview, you have to go through multiple rounds. That was probably one of the toughest year of my like last like decade almost. I basically almost cried every day or like every couple of days in subway, 3 a.m. I was alone in the subway, L train station. And then, you know, I those are, yeah. Anyway, I crossed that, but it was tough.
Mm-hmm. And it's crazy too to think about how you had this career and life's all set up for you, you know, back home in Bangladesh, and then you had a good job, you had this growing business, and now you come to the US and almost not only do you start from scratch, but you also kind of take a step back in some ways from a social aspect because you don't have this network of people and safety net. That's really tough. And honestly, that's, you know, it's what a lot of immigrants do in the US, right? Because I think they realize that overall the opportunities are going to be greater, but they're going to have to go through this period of like building everything from scratch again, you know, regardless of what they had back home. Not everybody, but a lot of people go through this.
I agree very much. And this is something which I, when I was sitting in the subways, this is a question which came to my mind so many times that why did I come? Was this a good decision? I think I made a seriously dumb mistake. Looking backwards, I think these are the times which kind of like builds the grit in you and builds the character. So honestly, after that, I became, so we came with this first point on use. I was choosing this uncertainty. Yes, I was choosing it for excitement or excitation, but you were talking something about that. I have this confidence that I can cross it. I had it, but it only became better with every time I went through this kind of like cliff, let's say, I don't know how to define them, but yeah.
Like a valley. I mean, it basically,
yeah.
No, that's fantastic. And like you said, it does build character, and you have to have a lot of that if you're going to start a company, because I mean, listen, I've had that same thought many, many times. I was a lawyer. I had a great job. I was in a good industry. You know, I could have just stayed in the industry and maybe been partner by now or whatever, you know, but instead it's like you choose to go through all these challenges. But I think you really do learn a lot and grow a lot throughout the way. Plus, I mean, the way that I look at it, it's easier now in hindsight, but it's so much more fun. You have different life experiences, you know, like you said, if you can envision the next 20 years of your life, is it fun? Is that really exciting? You know, I know how you feel, definitely. And by the way, I've been on the subway at 3 a.m. many, many times as well.
We could have met many times.
Yeah. Sometimes coming from studying and other times coming from partying, but you know, nevertheless. So you're in New York and you do finally land a job, right? I mean, after you graduate with your master's degree, you do finally land a job. And was that in T. Rowe Price or was that event that was later?
That was later. So I actually landed a job in, interestingly, LA from New York. So, I mean, wherever luck goes, I'll just follow.
Sure.
I got in Farmers Insurance, which is based primarily in LA. And they were doing a really cool project with Toyota where they were tracking, like basically through their iOS app, like building an insurance app, which will give people more insurance bonuses if their driving habits are good. And that job was really fun. I literally, all I did is coding, but also just driving throughout LA all day. Actually, the traffic was not fun, but overall just testing was fun. Because I was literally carrying like 5-6 iOS devices, like iPhones, and basically just testing how they're working in real time driving. But anyway, so that was my first job.
That's really interesting. That's fun too. That is fun. You know, you kind of to be out there in the world. That's probably kind of rare, I would think, for a job in software. Typically, you're just by your computer, and you don't have to actually go out in the field and do things. So that's pretty cool. And so great. So you got that, and then I guess you continued to grow, and it sounds like, you know, eventually you got into T. Rowe Price, right? And you sort of stayed there for some time, and you grew in the ranks. You know, I kind of want to get to this moment of when you started to think to yourself, because now you have the thing that you came here for. You came here for the degree, check, you got it. You know, you struggled to get that first job, you got it. You got a second job, you're growing, you know? If I put myself in your shoes though, knowing what I know about you now, I imagine that you look at it, you're like, okay, I got to this point where I feel comfortable, but now I can see the next 5, 10, 15 years. I'm not excited by this anymore. You know, how else can I leverage this like life, this opportunity here in the US? I'm assuming that that's, you know, just, I'm thinking like that maybe there was a little bit of that. I mean, was that the case, do you think, at all? Or am I kind of making that up?
No, man, you are getting me perfectly. This is how I think exactly. So, I think, honestly, in the first 2 years of T. Rowe Price, I was really enjoying it. I started as a junior iOS developer. I became a lead. I was handling iOS and Android. I was moving very fast within the corporate environment. But I realized that this is not particular to T. Rowe Price. This is actually all corporation period, is that the growth which comes to you by working in a large corporation is primarily more on the bureaucracy / like non-technical side sometimes. And I saw a lot of these flaws into the systems level in their applications or their or their software, which I thought that, okay, this, if I could just take leadership on fixing it, I would change it in like 1 month. It would not take me 1 year of basically convincing our managers to do it. And my manager was actually very helpful, but our manager has other managers. They had more managers. So I realized that in order to move things fast, maybe a big corporation just does not allow you to do that kind of speed. So I really liked the first 2 years of growth, but after that I was getting a little bit like I needed more growth and more excitement. So that was one thing. But I didn't have a specific idea on what I wanted to work on. I knew that I wanted to do something with mentoring or tutoring. I knew that I want to do something with immigration or helping immigrants somehow, because I was myself, but I didn't have a specific idea then. I tried testing out some ideas. Some of them didn't go through, but this one is working. But anyway, what I meant to say is that after 2 years in T. Rowe Price, I was actually kind of already planning that I'll do something. And that's that. Then when it basically started, mentally at least.
So, and I know that you also started sort of like a development shop, like, you know, your own kind of little consulting business, it sounds like. Did you do that sort of on the side when you were still working, or did you leave? Because I imagine that would help you scratch your itch of having more ownership and you know, taking more charge. Because you obviously, like you said, you're in a large company. There's bureaucracy. You can't just say you want to try something new and you get it. You have to go through. So was that the kind of thing where you just like you needed to get that energy out, that creative energy? So you started a company. Did you think that that was going to potentially become your full-time job eventually, or was it really just a side project sort of for fun?
So I started helping out a couple of startups on the side in the later years of T. Rowe Price, because I was already technically kind of like a technical architect role. So I could actually help becoming some kind of like fractional CTO kind of role. What I obviously wanted to do it full time. So after I left T. Rowe Price, basically all these relationships, which I was kind of doing casually, not really taking any money, just helping friends out, I started doing it a little bit more seriously for almost like 1-2 years. I still have this running because I have some relationships already, but I never wanted to be a dev shop long-term. Like, I didn't want to just keep building technology, but I didn't have a specific idea then. So I was just doing it still while figuring out. Mm. Yeah.
And I'm assuming that helped pay the bills.
Oh, definitely. It helped pay the bills. It helped me understand the technology better. I learned a lot of soft skills, how to work with people. These are always very transferable skills. So yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about, actually, you know what? I want to take a pause because I want to address a few more comments. And for folks who are still here and watching or just tuning in, again, say what's up. Tell us where you are. Tell us where you work. I love to see comments here. So we got a comment here from Kirill Dolinsky. He's actually my friend and neighbor. So he says, that's why he said, you know where I am. Hey, Kirill, thank you for joining. Your colleague, Anna, says she's learning new things about you. So that's fantastic. I'm really happy to hear that. Craig commented and I guess tagged somebody, said this might be of interest. Thank you, Craig, and thanks for being here. And Nicola, hi, everyone. Long time no see. Yeah, thanks, Nicola. It is a long time no see. But to be fair, I took a little pause on the show for a while, so it's not your fault. It's my fault. It's not you, it's me. So thanks, everyone, for your comments. And again, keep them coming. Always really appreciated. Fun to see who's here. And obviously, please ask us questions, especially once we get into the story of algorithms. It'll be great. Syed says hello everyone in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks so much for watching, Syed. Appreciate it. You're always here and that's awesome. I love it. Thank you. Okay, so I want to get to this moment where you've had all these different life experiences. You've immigrated a number of times in a way, sometimes without your, you know, when you were little, and of course again as an adult, you have this another aspect of you. You have this passion for tutoring and teaching and learning as well. And then you also have this entrepreneurial itch, right? And then you're also a technologist. So it feels like, in hindsight, the perfect soup, the perfect combination to build algorithm. But there has to be a moment where these things click in your head and you have to, and you know, the idea, at least a bud of an idea. So, I mean, do you remember, did you have that moment where, you know, you were like, huh, this is what I maybe should explore?
Yeah. So I don't think if it was that one moment or if I can track it specifically down on a date. It's more like a thread, which is like a little different rivers merging together. That is probably a better way to look at it. So actually, one thing I did not mention on this side, which I also started doing long back in 2010. So after I moved for my master's, I just created a Facebook group, which is a basic community just to help people to come to US and choose US universities. That's a Facebook group I created, and just as out of kind of like as a hobby. And essentially the goal was to give information to people that, okay, this is how you choose a US university. And because I went through the struggle, I just wanted to create a group and help people. And that is, I would say, probably more like the seed of this primary algorithm path. Obviously, there are multiple rivers which are meeting here. So what happened is that in the last almost like 10 years, that group became huge. Right now, we have more than 250,000 members. It is basically the largest group in Bangladesh for higher education. And I started casually as a hobby on the side just to help people. But now it's kind of like self-running almost with, we have like 20 admins, a lot of people there. Wow. Through that experience, I learned the power of community. I learned the power of sharing information. And essentially, I was trying to marry all these things, tutoring, running a community, helping people with technology. So I think I tried a couple of ideas before, as I said, but I'll come to algorithm, is that I wanted to do something which combined all these elements eventually. And with algorithm, I think the main thing hit, I'll skip my previous iterations of ideas because I tried one with making like a machine learning model. Matchmaking system for choosing universities that didn't work. That is my first failed startup, I can say. And then in 2020, when actually the COVID hit, that's the time when I kind of launched algorithm more officially. I had this idea, but I have seen that a lot of my friends who are working in H1B, they got fired. There was a big Excel sheet running around in COVID, during COVID, I think in May or June 2020. Where I saw so many immigrants just suddenly became really scared that they will lose their jobs, they will have to leave back to their home countries. And a lot of the students who are graduating, they're also very scared that, is it a good time to graduate? I don't know what will happen. So that's the time when I was thinking that I should probably focus on this group of people because they're really scared. And they're just coming to me. And I used to, through that Facebook group, which I built, because they already came to US and they're studying, we're having a lot of these posts in the group that, what do I do? Do I graduate now? I'm doing my master's, doing my undergrad. Do I just go to PhD and somehow not graduate? So I'm like, okay, maybe this is the time to just help them land job within this time constraint. And I basically registered the company in July 10th, 2020. Actually, it's going to be 2 years within a month. And we started our first cohort in September. Everything had to be pulled together super fast because there was this crisis of COVID and everyone was scared. So basically, that's how it kind of started.
What was that first cohort? I mean, what did it look like? Because you registered the company. Was there a website? Was there any sort of app or, you know, what did it look like for that first cohort?
For the first cohort, because it was such a quick execution, so registered the company and then basically we created the first website using WordPress within a week, basically just the first landing page. And then I basically posted in the Facebook group that, okay, I'm going to mentor you guys because I have been in technology, I can mentor you, blah, blah, all these things. I have lawyer friends who can help you with immigration. And essentially I just made a post and we had like 7 students in the first cohort. So that's how it started.
And was this free for them or were they?
It wasn't free. So one of the things which I actually learned from my running this community, which I still run as a voluntary thing, is that the problem with the thing is that in order for you to run something sustainably, you need to have some kind of financial leverage. If you don't have that, even the thing you love will eventually start becoming bitter for you because it's not going to be able to pay your rent and it will become more like a chore and not your love. And I wanted to keep helping people and mentoring people to be my love. So from basically building this Facebook community, I understood that I wanted to do this. I wanted to go all in with this cohort and there had to be some kind of financial leverage. And then it's not only me, I'm bringing all these friends who are working in Facebook, Google, all these big tech companies. I cannot just tell them to keep helping me for free without anything. So we basically said that, hey, dudes, we're just going to bring this cohort. Whatever they earn after graduation, you'll have some kind of split. Let's do this first run. So we basically started in that way. And so sorry for the last comment. And I basically loved the idea of this deferred tuition or income share agreement because I was looking at all these boot camps like Lambda School or a lot of the schools are actually doing it right now. That, oh, this is actually the sweetest spot because I do not or I cannot charge anything upfront to these students, but I want to give 40 hours, 60 hours per week to help these kids to land job. So I thought that the income share agreement or deferred tuition is the only sustainable way to actually make it win-win for both sides. So that's basically why I chose the business model. But you're saying.
Yeah, no, that's you answered my question because I was curious about how you did end up charging them. And I think you're right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And the idea is that they don't have resources. That's why they're coming to you. They're looking for a job. Trying to charge them would be, it wouldn't make much sense. So I think that's fantastic. So the first iteration of Algorizm was basically a website that shared some information about basically like a cohort of students that would learn from you, learn from others in your network, maybe get some advice or support on immigration. Were there hard skills involved or was it more like, here's how you navigate the job search. Here are the companies that are more likely to sponsor. Here are the skills that you should focus on while you're still in school. Was it a lot of guidance or were you giving like homework assignments and you're literally upskilling them on certain things too?
So there were hard skills involved. The primary things we did is that the people who we took are all engineers. So they have some kind of programming skill, but not fundamentally very strong. And I knew that obviously tech or software specifically as an industry has a very high demand. And because we are trying to land this student's job who has a time crunch, the only fastest path is actually going to tech. So they have some kind of programming skills, but maybe not ready for the current job market. Maybe they do not have the hands-on experience. So we provided them, we didn't take anyone who doesn't have any understanding of programming. We took people who have somewhat understanding and made them better, gave them more hands-on projects. And essentially it was an upskilling / hands-on project kind of bootcamp, because their gap was not necessarily learning how to code, but it was more like, what are the use cases of this code? Like, okay, do you know JavaScript, but you have no projects, you have no experience of working in US in the industry. So the hands-on experience was the primary thing we did. We gave them a lot of hands-on project, and they worked with all these engineers in Facebook, Google, and basically they learned how to work in a US corporation kind of environment, in a small simulation kind of way for 2 months or 3 months. So that was one thing. Yeah.
So it sounds like almost like an internship. It's like practical, hands-on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like an internship. And this is what I say, that we provide three I's. So one of them is internship, which is a hands-on experience. The second I is interview skills. Is essentially, we also provided them the soft skills, because they are technically sound, more or less, but they cannot really talk properly in a way that their storytelling skills are not good. They're all immigrants, came from all these different countries. So there is a little bit barrier of English as well. So we provide a lot of the soft skills to them as well. So that also went parallelly. And the third one is immigration. And the reason the immigration piece is super important here as well is because many of these students, although they are graduating with F1 degrees, they don't actually know. Some of them surprisingly don't even know how to file for an OPT, or like even the whole immigration part, like, oh, after OPT, there is OPT extension, there is H-1B, there is green card. They don't have the full idea of the whole immigration pathway. And then many of the times we actually also work with employers. So I'll give one case, is that there is this one kid who landed a job in a small business in Indiana. And they gave him the offer letter. And after that, said that, oh, shoot, you are an F1 student in OPT, but we cannot take you because we don't know how to do it. I literally sent my lawyer friends, talked with the HR people of that Indiana business, and basically made them a e-verified company, which literally takes 5 minutes. But they didn't know how to do it. And after that, they were able to hire this person. So we also provide this kind of support where we work with businesses or employers, especially smaller, medium businesses, where we help them hire more international student talents. So, yeah.
You know, that's amazing. And it's one of those things where, you know, you came in and provided some information to both the student and the company. I mean, it's a win-win. But my first thought was, well, Sam, this is not scalable. You can't send your friend to every single company, you know, and build a business out of this. So, you know, was that a thought that occurred to you, or were you kind of like, what was your plan on, all right, you're doing this, you're holding people's hands, you put this together quickly, but this can't be a business. You know, this can't be more than a small business. So, you know, what was that kind of next step where you said, all right, this has been great. I've learned a lot. I know what the needs are. I know what the companies need and the students need. Let me take it to the next step and make it into something that can grow, that can scale. How did you do that?
This is a very, very good question. So I rigorously, almost religiously follow Y Combinator's Paul Graham's notes. And the first cycle of startup is actually doing things which do not scale, because first we have to prove that there is demand and people can actually pay for it. And there is, if there is actual demand for the services. And through the first cohort, I actually learned that there is actually demand. There are employers who could take my services. There are students who could take our services. And then basically, after running three cohorts, I realized I know what are the exact bottlenecks for the students, what are the exact bottlenecks for the employers. And this is what we are focusing right now on, building a software platform, bringing my software skills in so that I can actually help both of these parties to scale. Because scale only comes when you have proven it for, let's say, 10 people. So now it the question becomes, how do I go from 10 students to 1,000, or 10 employers to 1,000 employers? So now we are working on scale.
So tell me, like, what does Algorizm do now? Are you guys in the development stage? Are you already launched and working with some people? I mean, there's always development, of course, but where's the company now, and sort of, you know, what's the pitch, I guess, out to the world?
The pitch is still the same. For the student side, it's essentially we help students land a job within that time constraint they have, and essentially provide them these three I's, which is immigration support, interview support, and also internship or hands-on experience support. So that still is there. In terms of building, or what we are building inside, so we are still doing it kind of no code way, or no tech, or low tech way. But what we started doing is that we are building a platform which will help us essentially, which will help students connect with employers directly through our platform. So that's what we are working on. And something which I did kind of like on a manual basis for the last 1 year is that we do something called shortest path calculation, meaning that the students, as I said, that they still have this problem that they have to land a job within a very super time crunched way. And they also have to know which employers are willing to hire them. So we have been doing this shortest path calculation manually, that, okay, like, what are your skills and what kind of jobs are you looking for? And if this is the shortest path for you, that if you do these things for the next 2 months, then you can land the job in a fastest way, because that is what they want. So we are building that tool so that this is available for all the students. So that's basically what we're working on now.
Can you give an example of what that would mean? Does it mean, okay, go for a iOS development job rather than a machine learning job because there are 10 times more iOS jobs? Or like, what does that practically mean?
Practically means that, let's say you are graduating with a electrical engineering degree. So we have these different muscle groups, we call. So we test the students on different muscle groups. Muscle groups are meaning, like, if you go to a gym, you have arms, abs. So if you're going to a career gym, we have soft skills muscle group, like English speaking, storytelling skills. And we have hard skills, like understanding Python, or having understanding on some specific languages or softwares. And essentially, we test all the students in the beginning throughout all these different muscle groups. And then we rank them, kind of like measuring their weight or blood, you know, so we measure them first. And then we see that, we say that, okay, you have literally 2 months time, and this is the job which is in highest demand. Based on our algorithm, I think this is the path which have the highest success rate for you to land a job. Because number one, this is a very highly available job. And then this is what, on average, someone takes to learn this skill. So does it make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you do have some sort of an algorithm or something that's calculating this. You put in some inputs based on that person's current state. And then you say, all right, here's kind of the path of least resistance to you to get a job.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's cool. And I mean, to me, that sounds like, you know, sort of the, whether it's proprietary or not, but that sounds to me like the value add here, particularly when a student needs, I mean, they need a job, to be quite honest with you. And so, you know, to your point, and honestly, as an immigration lawyer, and I hate to say this, but if you can get that H-1B, that first H-1B, go get that first H-1B. You know, if you don't love the job in 2 years, you can, you know, it's easier to get an H-1B transfer than it is to get that first one. And so I guess, to your point, getting that first job is crucial time-wise and also from an immigration standpoint. And then after that, they can maybe optimize for some of the other things that they perhaps didn't that first time around, because they needed to get it quickly and they needed to get it to get that H-1B, you know, at least even an offer, right? A company that knows what they're doing. That's cool. You know, So if I can ask this, and you know, feel free to share as much or as little as you want, but as a business person, you know, this sounds like it's technically challenging. You have to build partnerships with employers. You have to maybe build partnerships with universities and get that funnel of students. You obviously have to have people that are managing the students. How do you pay for all this? Like, how do you fund the continuing, you know, support and building of Algorism?
Good question. Until now, we have been completely bootstrapping. We did not raise anything. I just wanted to prove the business case first, which I think that we have solidly proven. Until now, the fundamental fuel was coming from the student side, because the students, the income share agreements have been the number one contributor. But starting this year, actually, we realized that employers are also a good place to essentially generate revenue from. We have partnerships with 4 companies right now, where we are essentially sending them our students, like talents, to work for them, and they are paying us. We have corporation to corporation relationships now, and one of the biggest clients we have is IBM. So we have a contract with IBM where IBM is paying us as a corporation, and we are hiring someone through H-1B as our own employee. So that is becoming the employer side of the revenue funnel is just opening up, but that is probably where we are also probably going to focus more.
That's interesting. So it's kind of like going into a consulting or like staffing firm model, where you actually hire the individual, you know their skill set, you know what they're capable of, you have the demand from companies for different projects, and you can sort of be that middle person and connect the talent with the company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's also cool, because that puts you in the middle of the H-1B process. Now you're not just talking to students about it, you're actually doing it. And so you'll end up optimizing for that one way or another as sort of the employer yourself.
Yeah, that's something which I did not even imagine that we will do so fast. We are just literally, we started September 2020, the first cohort. This year we filed for our first H-1B. I cannot still imagine that I'm running a company where we can file for people's H-1B. But yeah, that definitely, not only that we are doing H-1B, we're applying for a green card. So definitely I'm sure that we can help a lot more people. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. That's a very exciting step. And, you know, to your earlier point of opening doors that are unknown, and this is one of those like curveballs that who would have thought, right? I mean, it goes from a tutoring, from tutoring to, you know, helping students navigate the process to now being that employer. And so the focus is also now building relationships with the companies that will, you know, hire the talent from you. Which is really awesome. And so is there still a tech component? You know, I guess as we're thinking through this, I'm starting to see Algorism as almost like a multi-step process, where you work with the student when they're earlier on, perhaps they're still a student, maybe they have a few years left in their career, they learn the 3 I's, right? They're upskilling. And then upon graduation, now you can also give them an opportunity to hire them and connect them with employers. So are you seeing yourself as like stepping more into the international student journey than just educating them and mentoring them?
Very, very. And this is a very good question to ask in this moment, because so obviously the hands-on mentoring or personalized mentoring, as you said, is not scalable for 200,000 new international students who are graduating every year. We can only probably support 100 or 200 maximum per year in this model we're operating. So that's basically where the tech component is coming in all this learning of doing this shortest path calculation. Essentially, we have data of last 2 years of students and also from job landing. So that's the part I was going to say, is that we're building a machine learning model where this shortest path calculation is done by tech. And this is also just readily available for anyone who is still studying as an international student. Let's say they're in the second year, third year of their BSc degree. And essentially they can just go and open a profile here, sign up and do all these tests. And essentially they will be able to see which are the right employers. They will have the employer matching, and also the shortest path calculation will be done like more on a dynamic basis, and they will see that, oh, if I just learn this skill, the shortest path will become even shorter. So that's basically what we're trying to build. The tech component will come for primarily on the student side. So it will primarily help the students. That's what we're rolling out first, but it could also help the employer. We're still not focusing on that side yet, but yeah, primarily building the tech for the students now.
That's super cool. It's really exciting. I mean, it's a great idea, honestly, because I think, especially when you're a student, and I mean, you're a perfect example of someone, I think, who really is interested to learn about a lot of different things, Greek mythology, you know, comic books, engineering, you know, architecture, et cetera. But practically speaking, you have to narrow that down a little bit, because you can't be a jack of all trades, as they say. You may not get hired. And so it's almost like the algorithm you're building, the way that I'm hearing it, is basically saying, hey, listen, you have all these skills right now. Great. But your goal right now is to get a job. So if you focus, out of all the things that you've told us that you're good at and that you know, if you focus on these two things, that'll allow you to be skilled enough to get a job in 2 months. Whereas if you focus on these other things that you also are interested in, that'll take you 9 months to be able to be at a level to get a job.
Correct. And additionally, these are the employers who are more immigration friendly, who will actually probably also hire you. So that's an additional thing as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Not all companies hire immigrants, and there are a list of employers who are more immigration friendly. So that's also the part.
Especially for kind of somewhat recent graduates, right? They might be immigration friendly if the person is 5 to 7 years, but if they have, even with a master's degree, if you don't have a lot of work experience, you know, they need to have a structure for younger employees that they can. So, that's a puzzle for sure, but it sounds like you're well on your way to putting a lot of the different pieces together. So that's really exciting. I had two comments here. One from Syed says, hello, Siam. Bayamar Bari Komila. I hope you know what that means, because I don't.
He means that his hometown is in Kumila, which is a town in Bangladesh. Hey, Syed, nice meeting you. He's also from Bangladesh.
That's so cool. Thank you, Syed. That's awesome. And I have a great question here from Awais. He says, have you run into any issues with ISA payments, the income sharing agreement? Repayment, sorry. Awais says there have been reports that they could be challenging because the best students end up paying more. So I guess the issue, or not the issue, but I guess it's like a self-selective thing where you only end up working with the best students, and then you, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but from that perspective, but maybe that first question, do you find, you know, how do you force them to repay, right? I mean, other than suing, for example, which you probably don't want to do.
Yeah, good question. We definitely do not we have very good relationships with our students. So the ISA repayments honestly had not been an issue until now at all. So we have 33 students who have graduated, who are basically our alumni, and not even with one single person we had a repayment issue. The second point is that the best students end up paying more does not apply to us, because we have a ISA cap. So the total they pay us is maximum 15,000, and they would not pay under any circumstances more than that ever. And they only pay that if they're hitting that salary cutoff point. So if they're not making more than 50K, if they have to leave back to their home, if they lose their job, they do not have to pay. They can come back to us and retrain. So essentially, it kind of works mentally for them, almost like an insurance policy that, oh, like I have a job, but if after 3 months I am again back to the pavilion, I know that I can come to Algorithm. And I think that gives them a big mental peace that I can come back to Algorithm and they will retrain me. And again, I'll go back to the job search mode. So yeah. The first question was that how do we ensure? So we do not handle this thing. We actually work with other partners. We work with companies like Blair or Meritas. These are basically financing companies who essentially handle these students' ISA sites. We just focus on mentoring. So they handle our finances and we just focus on mentoring. So yeah.
That's awesome. And that's actually really smart, because that's like outsourcing the things that are not your you know, focus, and nor should it be. You're not a financial collections agency. You are a mentorship technology, you know, job matching platform or company. So that's really good. It's a really good, I think, lesson too, especially in the beginning for a company. Don't try to be everything. You know, focus on the thing that you're good at, and then try to find other people or companies or services or products that you can sort of connect together in a puzzle piece to get everything that you need. I mean, a good example is, you know, payments, like using Stripe for payments. You know, don't build your own payment system. Go plug in with an API through, you know, with somebody who is already doing this and is really good at it. That's really awesome. So, you know, as we kind of wrap up here, you know, I'm curious. I think we all have an idea, a really good idea of where what Algorizon is building right now, and sort of the benefit that you hope to have on these students. Where do you see the company? You know, what's your vision? You know, over the next, let's say, 5 years. I mean, you can continue to go this like H-1B kind of consulting or staffing model route. It could be kind of, you know, what are your thoughts on that, if any? You know.
Yeah, this is a good question. I think 5-year plans are a little bit difficult to say in a way that, I mean, we are still a startup, still navigating in terms of what is the exact focus and how do we pivot. It's difficult to say and stick to for the 5 years. It's impossible actually as a startup. But I can tell more like a 10-year plan or 10-year vision is that the biggest loss here is that if I think I'm not, hopefully I'm not a very dumb person. And basically after graduating from my master's degree, if I took 10 months to land my first job, and I know that there are so many immigrants who are struggling here in that space, and they're actually already kind of pre-selected group of immigrant. They have gone through the US education system. They are decently smart. The biggest loser here economically is actually the US. And basically, economically, after a certain amount of time, I want to prove this case that bringing in all these international students to US is great. US has done a good job on marketing or user acquisition side with Spider-Man. But they have not done a good job on retention of these great talents, because this is the winning edge for US as a country. And the longer term, this is what I want to really fight for or prove economically that, hey, these are the people who are building your infrastructure, tech infrastructure or any infrastructure within the country. And they are also the people who are founders. They're building companies. They're job creators, job doers. They're the biggest, like highest contributor in generating more GDP for your country. So the longer term is essentially building this platform for the immigrants and essentially empowering job creation, and also slowly, that's why I'm saying 10-year vision, is to empower more immigrant entrepreneurs. That would be the like somehow becoming the ecosystem or hub so that we can support more immigrant entrepreneurs, so that I can actually just talk to someone in US that, hey, we are basically running the country. Just make this process easier, because eventually the whole immigration process is more political and not necessarily a tech problem to solve. So that's where I want to go longer term, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, I mean, that's a great vision, and I think there are a lot of people out here, especially our listeners, who back you on that vision. So I wish you the best of luck on that. I think you're on the right path, and it feels like you're definitely the right person to do it.
Thank you, man. Thanks a lot for inviting. And I feel honored. I love that we are creating all these immigrant powered entrepreneur cluster. So thanks a lot for inviting me and creating this community.
Absolutely. And thank you for being here. I invite people to visit your website, Algorizon, Algorizin, right? .com, to check out the website and you know, hope to continue to hear good news and keep us in mind when when you're talking to the White House or to Congress about all the great things that immigrants are contributing to the country. So I think that'll be great.
Thank you, man. We'll do it together.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate your time here, man. What an inspiring episode. You know, it's funny. I usually try to end on like kind of a funny maybe joke or question or something like that. But I thought that that idea of this 10-year vision and, you know, figuring out a way to continue to prove and show that immigrants really do make America better and more competitive and are creating jobs and everything is really powerful. So I'm really happy that we got to end it there. See you next week for another great episode. In the meantime, have a wonderful weekend. Stay safe and see you later.